Strangers, I have a confession. After I got my dad a StoryWorth subscription, I did something wild. I bought myself a subscription. Every week, StoryWorth sends me thoughtful questions to answer, and at the end, they'll send me a beautiful book with all my answers and any photos that I've sent in. I answer the questions on Sunday nights before my work week gets going, just as a nice way to reset. I love StoryWorth. It's a great way to pass on family history. Plus, you can choose the questions if you want. So when StoryWorth asked me about prom, which I never went to, I just popped over to the site and switched out the question. Imagine someday your grandkids holding your personalized history in their hands. You can write your answer or record it on your phone, and StoryWorth will transcribe it. This year, they've added a bunch of new features to make storytelling even easier, with personalized questions and Magic Editor. Meanwhile, their magic layout and new book designs make finished books, and especially photos, look even more beautiful. Plus, they've just rolled out Spanish language support. What's not changing? Customers' love for StoryWorth. They've printed over a million books and preserved 35 million family stories since their founding 13 years ago. They have over 48,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. Give your loved ones a unique keepsake you'll all cherish for years. StoryWorth Memoirs. Right now, save $10 or more during their holiday sale when you go to storyworth.com/daisy. That's storyworth.com/daisy to save $10 or more on your order. Hey, strangers. This week, I'm treating you to an interview with the excellent Lizzie Bassett and Chris Winterbauer from the awesome podcast, What Went Wrong. They had me on their show at the end of October, and I brought them here to tell us all about what went wrong with the filming of the 1994 cult classic, The Crow. Enjoy. I'm so excited to do this. I was so excited to join your show, which aired a couple weeks ago. We covered, the hell was that movie called?
Brainstorm.
Brainstorm, your favorite movie, Brainstorm.
Right. We covered Brainstorm, Natalie Wood's final movie. I learned so much, and I have since just listened to your show because it's so interesting. You know, I'm not a movie buff, and so it's helped me to sort of re-examine movies from a different angle. The Blair Witch episode was really interesting.
Honestly, that's like one of the most depressing ones I feel like we've done recently, just because of how horribly those actors were treated.
Yes. Yeah. I auditioned for the sequel.
Oh, wow.
Book of Shadows?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I just kind of made fun of the movie in the audition because I was a brat. Mm-hmm. But I will also say that I bought into it. I remember watching, like, I don't know if it's a documentary or a commercial about it, at a bar.
Yep.
And I remember sitting there being like, wow, this is crazy. They found this. I completely bought into it 100%. Yep. I watched the entire movie thinking it was real.
That marketing campaign was incredible.
Mm-hmm. It was wild. It was great. And then a friend of mine was telling me that she was at Emerson when Paranormal Activity came out, and there was a huge viral campaign for that as well, which worked. But today we're talking about The Crow from 1994. My connection to this movie is just that I auditioned for it.
Really?
Yes. And I think that I have a diary entry about it. I have to dig out that diary. But I think I was really excited because I was like, I'll have to learn how to ride a skateboard.
So this would have been for the little girl.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was exactly. Yeah. She's my age. I looked her up.
13 or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. 14.
When you auditioned. Yeah.
Sarah, I think, is her character's name.
Yeah. Incidentally, I auditioned for all of those movies, mm-hmm. you know, and got really close, you know, Interview with the Vampire, Little Women,
Whoa.
The Professional.
We just talked about Natalie Portman didn't get Little Women, and then she got Heat.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it came down to me and Natalie Portman. You know, that's one of those roles that I think she was just so undeniably beautiful, which is weird to say mm-hmm. about an 11-year-old child. But yeah, Kirsten Dunst booked a lot of the roles that I didn't book.
Wow.
Jumanji, right. Yeah.
Snatched him right up.
Tower of Terror with Steve Guttenberg. Nobody remembers that
one. I did not
audition.
I don't think I auditioned for that one.
It was one of the first Disney movies based on one of their theme park rides.
Sure, yeah. Sure. I did audition for, it was called Born Jaundiced, but it turned into My Girl.
Oh.
Oh, Anna my Plumsky. God.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Born Jaundiced.
Could you imagine?
I mean, it would have given a better sense of the tone of the eventual film.
Yeah.
My Girl, or the movie that traumatized all of us at a young age.
Yeah.
and made us misunderstand love for years and years and years.
Yeah, there's, you know, a lot of movies from the 90s, I think, really made us misunderstand love. And also sort of misunderstand, like, codependency for love, you know? Or, like, you know.
Stalking for love.
Stalking, exactly. Like, pursuing somebody until they say yes. Which is funny, because, you know, now watching things with my kid, who's 12, you know, we watch things that are older, and I have to remind them, we don't do this. If somebody says no, they mean no.
Don't stand outside of Keira Knightley's house with a choir and a bunch of creepy cards.
Yeah. Don't steal a girl's underwear and show them off to all the boys in the bathroom.
Please don't do that.
Not that I've shown them 16 candles. John Hughes is going to be off limits for a while. A while. But today we're talking about The Crow. And full disclosure, I just watched it for the very first time this morning in preparation for this. Thanks.
What did you think?
I didn't like it.
Really?
Listen, I'm cranky and curmudgeon-y. You know, I thought it was like John Wick did the revenge movie better.
Well, it's an interesting John Wick connection to this movie, so we'll come back to that.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's very like Batman-y, Gotham-y, comic book-y, but it's also, I found it to be tremendously corny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very corny.
There are like a lot of movies from this era that it spawned, has like a similar tone.
Yeah.
I'm closer to you, Daisy. I think Lizzie liked this movie a lot more than I did.
I did like it. Yeah. But I will say, you know, I watched this movie in the context of having done a bunch of research on, you know, obviously Brandon Lee and the story behind this. And so I'm sure that that colored my perception of it. But I also think I'm maybe a little more comfortable with sort of like the camp and cheese. And I did enjoy it a lot. There's no exposition, which I really like.
Yes, yes. And it is so quintessentially 90s.
Yes.
Grunge. I mean, I was taken right back there. So that was fun. But also knowing, you know, what happened on the movie, just all the gun violence, I think, just becomes more upsetting. And I don't even really know the details. So I can't wait to learn about it. Do you want to just sort of set the movie up a little bit?
Sure. So as you pointed out, this movie came out in 1994. It was directed by Australian director and I believe first-time feature director at the time of this film, Alex Proyas. It was written by James O'Barr. It's based on his comic. There were also screenwriters David, I believe it's Scow, and John Shirley, who came on board for the script as well. Stars, of course, Brandon Lee, who we're going to talk about a bunch, Ernie Hudson, Michael Wincott. I love Michael Wincott. He's top dollar, the main villain in this.
Who's the actor who played the Candyman?
Tony Todd.
Tony Todd, yes.
Tony Todd,
he's in this. Bai Ling, Michael Massey, who we will also talk about quite a bit. There's a ton of people in this.
Yeah.
And I'll share the IMDb logline, as we always do on our show. It's a man brutally murdered comes back to life as an undead avenger of his and his fiance's murders.
That's pretty much it.
That is as far as they went. Yeah.
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 Tell me a little bit about Brandon Lee, if you can. Like, coming into this film, how he got this film, and where he came from.
Definitely. So, I mean, I'm actually going to hand this to Chris, because Brandon Lee, if anybody doesn't know, was Bruce Lee's son. And Chris covered quite a bit of Bruce Lee when we did Big Trouble in Little China. And that's actually really important context to understand Brandon Lee and where he was. So, Chris, I don't know if you want to sort of set up his father a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. So it's kind of difficult to understate how successful Bruce Lee was at the peak of his powers, which was right at the turn of the like late 60s into the early 1970s. And he had come to the United States and he was successful on television initially. And then he was very successful with these movies made out of China, these kung fu films that were made in China that were, in terms of budget to box office, amongst the most successful films ever made. I mean, we're talking about a 100x multiplier, because the movies could be made so cheaply in China because the cost of labor was so low and they were so successful internationally. And they were successful for a whole bunch of reasons. The action was obviously very new to people around the world, but the stories very much were underdog stories and outsider stories, and they appealed across cultures really well. I mean, there was one part I remember, they were very successful, like in Lebanon, for example, and was like beating out The Godfather, you know, Enter the Dragon in Lebanon, you know, back in the early 70s. And so Brandon was born in 1965. And this is in Oakland, California. Bruce is very young, you know, at this point in time. And if you've seen Bruce in interviews, he's incredibly charismatic.
Yeah.
Not the greatest trained actor, but the way he can move his body is incredible. And the control he has over his body and his face. He's a kind of feels like a born performer, I think, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. There are some funny stories. He did have a bad habit, I've read, of tagging other stunt performers. And this is when you don't pull your punch or your kick
Ooh.
During what's supposed to be a staged fight. And he would uh-huh. actually make contact with other stunt performers and he would blame them. And maybe apocryphal story I've heard is Judo Jean LaBelle, who's a very famous fighting instructor. I've heard in some ways Brad Pitt's character in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is maybe a little bit inspired by him. Bruce Lee had made a bad habit of tagging these stunt performers and had said, I could beat up anyone of any size. And Judo Jean is a very big guy. And he just at one point picked him up and just held him in the air and was like, you need to stop tagging other stunt performers. Like, these yeah. are your coworkers. Because, yeah. you know, Bruce Lee, very cocky, but could back it up. And so what's really tragic is he dies in 1973, and he's only 32 years old.
Oh, wow.
This is like right at the height of his output. He's an international superstar. He's doing an ADR session for Enter the Dragon, collapses, goes to the hospital, cerebral edema, swelling of the brain. 2.5 months later, you know, he passes away.
And is that from all of his physical exploits, or is it just a weird tragic coincidence?
I don't know if we know that.
The autopsy, I believe, was reactions to a painkiller that he'd taken earlier in the day. And there are a lot of theories surrounding that. I don't get the mm-hmm. sense that this was like a CTE, you know, sort of thing. And that he suffered yeah. repeated brain trauma. Everything I've read, he very much took care of his body. You know, despite doing a lot of stunt work, I don't get the sense he was doing a lot that was hitting his head, for example. There were a lot of rumors, though. There were rumors that he had been poisoned, you know, that this was like an assassination, a hit job of some kind. And so Brandon is 8 years old when he Oof. Loses his father, when Bruce Lee Awful. Passes away.
I mean, the reason that we're starting with Bruce Lee is not, you know, as soon as I said that, I was like, oh, I don't want to detract from Brandon Lee because that was something that sort of dogged him his whole career.
Of
but
course.
That's also why we're talking about Bruce Lee, because the legacy of his father dogged him his entire career.
And the legacy of his father
of his
passing
father dying,
away
yes.
at 32 years old, you know, so early in his career.
Yes. And yeah, Brandon was 8. You know, he did not dive immediately into acting. He did dedicate himself to studying martial arts. And that's where he really started. He really threw himself into like developing different movement styles, like different fighting styles. And I have to say, in The Crow, like, the way that he moves is gorgeous. I think similar to what Chris is talking about with Bruce Lee, Brandon Lee has his own style of moving, his own style of fighting. He's very beautiful. I find him like physically very easy to watch. And I'm not talking about the fact that he's handsome, obviously. He was very handsome.
Right.
But just there's an ease of movement with him that I think comes from the amount of work that he did on this stuff. But he does eventually turn to acting and he starts taking some roles. But by the time he was cast in The Crow, he was not an established star. I think the biggest credits to his name were like Showdown in Little Tokyo next to Dolph Lundgren, something called Rapid Fire with Powers Booth. Like, mm-hmm. this guy is not a household name. But he was a huge, huge fan of The Crow comics. And there were a couple of other, you know, big 90s names that I believe were considered for the part of Eric Draven.
Okay.
Well, do you want to guess, Daisy? There's three that I know were considered but not offered the part.
Keanu Reeves.
No, and I think it's because he hadn't
Too
quite
young.
Broken out yet with like Speed.
Yeah, this is right before Speed. He had
yeah.
done Point okay. Break, but he hadn't done Speed yet.
Yeah.
All right. Gosh, mid-90s. Brad Pitt?
No.
This is right before he breaks out too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because Interview with the Vampire is same year as The Crow. Yep.
I don't know. Who?
Christian Slater was one name that was bandied okay. about. Johnny Depp, you know, discussed.
Duh.
River right. Phoenix discussed a little bit. But as far as I could find, this part was not offered to anyone other than Brandon Lee. I think they saw him. They felt that he was right for this part right away. They approached him. I also think he was actually involved in the pre-production for this movie for like at least a year before it started filming.
Oh, wow.
And really was, you know, was like an important part of the development of this movie. So that's kind of where he is when this starts, is he is not out of his father's shadow, by any means. And this movie is very much poised to do that for him.
Sure. Yeah, he's gorgeous. And
yeah.
And I think it's one of those things where he offers the production something they need as well. This is a low budget movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think $15 million.
First time director who is a very accomplished commercial and music video director. He had an incredible reel and, you know, everyone wanted to work with him. But again, low budget. They need a lead. I mean, do they need somebody who's a great thespian? Not really for the material. They need someone who's very physical,
right?
Who's captivating and can do convincingly the action choreography that they need this character to do.
Yeah.
And he could big time.
And this character is going to be in heavy makeup for a lot of the film, which funny enough would become a hallmark of Johnny Depp, I feel like, across his career.
Yeah.
But
yes.
It does, in my mind, it really does fit an actor like Brandon Lee, where they say, okay, physicality first, we've got the legacy, yeah, and maybe there's a way to market it as this is Bruce Lee's son taking up the mantle. I think there are a lot of, not cynical, but practical, pragmatic reasons,
sure,
why he makes sense. And I think that for him, this movie makes a lot of sense because it can show off all the things he knows he's really good at,
mm-hmm,
and it gives him a chance to flex a little bit of, hopefully, the acting chops, you know,
yeah,
that he might want to show off.
And also, like, this was a very, I mean, it's not Batman, but this was a very popular independent comic. Like, there is definitely the potential here for, if this takes off, this is a franchise. And so I completely understand the appeal of this. There's something I remember reading when I was researching when we did our episode on The Crow, though, that just kind of tells you exactly what they were looking for across the board, behind the camera, and I think also in front of the camera, was, as Chris said, this is a low budget movie. It was a $15 million budget, which when you think about a comic book movie, that's really, really low.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said was, we're looking for 30-year-olds with 30 years of experience. So it's like, they're not going to hire the people who have been in the industry who are at the top of their game. They are looking for, right, people who are entering the industry, looking for, mm-hmm, opportunities, but they are expecting those people to come in with the experience of, you know, like, storied department heads. And that doesn't exist.
Well, yeah, or Daisy, yeah, to your point, you know, and to your experience, they're kind of looking for the equivalent of child actors. And that's, in a, yeah, sense, uh-huh, that's a little bit of what Brandon Lee brings too, right? Is that, yeah, he was raised by somebody who was making movies. He has been on sets. So, mm-hmm, even though, yeah, he hasn't been in a lot of movies, this isn't going to be new to Brandon Lee, I think, in, right, a lot of ways. And so they're, right, kind of getting a little bit of that experience through osmosis with him as well.
Interesting.
And there was a professionalism he brought.
Yes.
That, right, you know, obviously he took it very seriously, mm-hmm, but he knew how to take it seriously too,
yeah,
because,
yeah,
I think of his pedigree.
Right, of course. Yeah, it's interesting to think of somebody like River Phoenix in that role. I mean, I think he was really struggling, mm-hmm, at that point,
yeah,
as,
yeah,
well. So,
but also probably too expensive.
Too expensive. And then he would have needed a stunt double, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I think Brandon Lee's physical performance in this movie, yeah, is great.
Insane.
And Lizzie and I think to part a little bit on this, I don't find his acting very convincing in the dramatic moments.
I like it. I think it fits the tone of the movie.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody gives a really terrific performance,
right, yeah,
acting wise in the film. So
maybe Ernie Hudson.
Well, sure. But it doesn't stick out because,
no,
everybody's, yeah, sort of being goofy.
Mm-hmm.
I think Phoenix would have, I can see the dramatic elements being more interesting with him.
Yeah.
I just rewatched True Lies and the number of shots where I'm like, that's not Arnold Schwarzenegger, as they're just doing blatant, yeah, stunt, yeah, doubles. That would have been, yeah, River Phoenix in this,
yes,
movie.
Yeah, 100%. And then they would have had to pay extra.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, for the second person.
I'll just say he did have a stunt double on this.
Okay.
There's someone else who's a very famous stuntman who later becomes involved in the project that we can talk about, but he was not initially involved.
All right. Strangers, the holidays are coming and you know what that means. Eating right goes out the window. But your digestive system doesn't have to suffer with Symbiotic Plus, a 3-in-1 powerhouse of clinically studied pre, pro, and postbiotics to support a balanced gut microbiome. Ritual Symbiotic Plus is designed with a delayed release capsule to help reach the colon, not the stomach, an ideal place for probiotics to survive and grow. One daily mint-scented capsule for bloat, gut, and regularity support. You don't have to refrigerate them, so you can carry them in your purse, put them in your glove compartment, or in your overnight bag when you head to families, and not worry about it. I love that it's vegan friendly and formulated without GMOs, major allergens, animal products, shady fillers, and artificial colors. Plus, it's HSA and FSA eligible with a seamless checkout experience so you can save when you shop with pre-tax dollars. So get your gut going. Support a balanced gut microbiome with Ritual Symbiotic Plus. My listeners get early access to their Black Friday sale for 40% off your first month at ritual.com/strange. That's ritual.com/strange for 40% off your first month. Don't miss out on their best sale of the season. Strangers, great news for those of you who love the show but hate the ads or are angry at Spotify and Apple for running ads for ICE. Strange and Unexplained and all the shows on my network, Grab Bag Collab, are available early and ad-free. You can choose to subscribe to just Strange and Unexplained or bundle a few shows or get them all. We're adding new quarterly shows all the time, but we always have Strange, Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and her show The Catalyst, my advice show Dear Daisy, which is kind of like a bi-weekly Ask Me Anything, except I answer listeners who write in for life advice, and my Love is Blind recap podcast Shut the F Up, Nick Lachey. Plus, there's all kinds of bonus content, including live recordings. Right now, you can join and get a whole year at 20% off if you go to grabbagcollab.com and use the code EARLYBIRD20. That's 20% off your whole first year of ad-free shows and lots more. You can also join via Apple subscriptions. Remember, you have two ways to listen ad-free, so no more complaints about the ads, okay? I have to feed my family. Thanks! Tragically, Brendan Lee got shot. Mm-hmm. From a live round in a gun that was supposed to have a... Oh, okay, great. Go for it.
So this was one of my favorite episodes to do because we actually, in preparation for this, we spoke to an armorer named Larry Zanoff, who has worked on like Captain America, Winter Soldier, Ant-Man, like just, you know, tons and tons of movies. This guy is responsible for probably a lot of the guns that you have seen. And he was an actual gunsmith, meaning that he can build the guns. And that was really important to me. And you can actually listen to our interview with him as well on our page, because he did a really great job of explaining how this happened. And it's like a Rube Goldberg machine of mistakes. Mm-hmm. It's not just one thing. It's actually not live ammunition that was in the gun. So I can kind of walk you through what happened. So first of all, do you know, like, technically what the job of an armorer on set is? Because I didn't.
I think they are in charge of the weapons, the handoff, the handling of it, and the loading, unloading.
Yes.
Checking to make sure that they're blanks.
Exactly, yeah. So they are responsible, completely responsible for all of the weapons on set, particularly the guns. They should not be out of the armorer's sight. He told a story where he was hired onto a job and they were like, oh, there's only two guns. Are you going to be able to handle that? And he was like, yeah, two guns is fine. Like, I can keep my eyes on two guns. And he got there and one of the people with a gun was on the roof and the other was on the street. And he said, I'm not doing this because they have to have eyes on the weapons that they're monitoring at all times.
Yeah.
And they obviously they're locking them up if they're doing this right. You know, they're checking everything, yada, yada. You get the idea. So they had an armorer working on this movie, but I believe because of the budget, that armorer had been sent home for one of the shots that they were grabbing, which was an insert shot. And this was actually, I think, weeks before the incident with Brendan Lee. Chris, do you want to explain what an insert shot is?
Cut away to a specific item, action, typically does not involve any of your main, you know, cast or players. It could be a shot of a prop. It could be a gun in a hand. I believe in this instance, it's the gun going off in the character's hand. Insert shots are annoying because they're necessary, but they can be nice in the sense that you could shoot them with a second unit. You could shoot them in advance. You could shoot them after the fact. And that's what's happening in this instance here.
Right.
I was in a film where I had to take a mallet. To a pair of rats that were populating. And they were
not
real
where I
rats,
you were going,
but they were dead. And they were staged. I wouldn't do it. So they did an insert of somebody else in my leg costumes and my shoes doing the mallet. I was not there. I was not present for the rat smashing.
Oh my. I can't believe they asked you to do it.
I was 14.
No.
It must have been like an indie film, I'm guessing. That's what you do on an indie film. They just go, Daisy can do it. Yeah, it's fine.
I mean, I also like had to make out with an adult man. I was listening to the interview with the vampire episode, and I was like, oh yeah, the making the child kiss a full grown adult is a real thing.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Anyway,
well, that's
gonna
be a second episode. So yeah, they were grabbing an insert shot. Chris is right. They were grabbing an insert shot of a gun going off. And because of the way that it was being shot, you know, obviously they need the gun firing, but they actually wanted a shot straight down the barrel. And because of the kind of gun that it was a revolver, I believe, in this shot. You can see the bullet. If you look down the barrel of a revolver, you can physically see the bullet in there. So they need something in the gun for when the camera is doing that. Otherwise, it's going to look empty. And typically what you would use for this is something called a dummy round, meaning it's literally just, I think, I could be wrong about this, it's just the actual bullet. There's no kind of...
It's empty.
It's well, even beyond empty, there's
no
nothing
primer,
that could potentially
no
ignite it. Exactly.
Right.
There's zero explosives involved in a dummy round. And that's what it's used for. It's so that you can, it looks like there's something in the gun. So because I think this was a second unit shoot, they're tight on budget, they're tight on time. They did not have an armorer around for this. And also, they're shooting in North Carolina. They're not shooting in, you know, Hollywood or Vancouver or whatever, where you can access this stuff quickly. So they didn't have dummy rounds. So what someone did was they went to a gun shop, they got live ammunition, and they thought, hey, I understand what a dummy round is. It's a bullet without any, you know, ignition behind it, no gunpowder, no nothing. So they took them apart and they dumped all of the gunpowder out. And I think they were like, all right, it's out. This is not a bullet. There's nothing to, you know, propel this out of the barrel. They put it in there, they point in a safe direction, they go click, 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 click with the gun, you know, to make sure that nothing is firing to test it. What they didn't realize was as they did that, whatever makeshift dummy round they were using, they had emptied out the gunpowder. They had not successfully removed the primer. And I had to look this up, but the primer is basically like a very small amount of explosive that sets off a really small ignition that then ignites the gunpowder. That is what then sets off the big explosion inside the gun, and that then propels the bullet down the barrel. So there was no big explosion. There was nothing that you would have even really heard or seen. It probably was just a click. But what happened was that primer was not removed. It did ignite. It caused this little tiny explosion. And what that did was it popped the actual physical bullet off of the casing. So they're able to remove the casing from the gun. But what happens at this point is now the bullet has lodged into the barrel of the gun. So there's a barrel obstruction. Nobody checks this. All you would have had to do is look down the barrel of the gun with a flashlight, and you would have been able to see it, that there is something in the barrel. And nobody does that for, I believe, weeks, at least days. Mm-hmm. So when it comes time to shoot the scene, it's when the actual attack is happening. It's when Eric Draven is being, you know, shot at the beginning.
Okay.
I think they were shooting this sequence with like, I want to say like 8 days left in the actual production. The actual filming of this was quite late in the production. Mm-hmm. And Michael Massey, one of the actors who I mentioned, who plays Fun Boy in the movie, the one who kind of looks like Iggy Pop.
Yes.
He was handed this gun that had the bullet, unbeknownst to anyone, lodged in the barrel of the gun. So it's not even live ammunition. It's literally just a barrel obstruction. There's an object in there. And because they're firing at him, they want the guns to be going off, they put a blank in the gun. And the thing that I feel like most people don't understand about blanks is that they're actually still quite dangerous. You can't hold that close to somebody's head because there is still, you know, a propulsion out of the end of the gun that can hurt somebody.
Yeah.
In order to make that noise, there is an explosion with the blank. The difference with the blank, I believe, is that obviously there's nothing to propel. But of course, now you have something in the barrel of the gun. So they're shooting the scene. They go bang, 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 bang. They shoot Brandon Lee exactly as they're supposed to. He falls exactly as he's supposed to. The squibs and the grocery bags go off just as they're supposed to. Everybody thinks it's gone fine, except that he does not get up.
Oh, God.
And it took them like a minute or two to realize something was really wrong. They went over to him. They saw, you know, a silver dollar sized hole there was blood pooling. You know, obviously they call an ambulance immediately. I don't think he ever regained consciousness. And after several hours of surgery, he did die at the hospital.
Awful.
It's awful. And it's so unnecessary because, you know, had there been an armorer there that day, they would not have let them do that if they were doing their job right. Had someone checked the weapon either after they'd done that shot or before they handed it to Michael Massey, you know, that would not have happened. Like, there are just so many steps that were missing because they were cutting corners. They were moving fast. It was a cheap production.
This is what I say about Boeing.
Yeah.
You know, you cut corners and fucking doors fall off of airplanes.
Yes, it's true. And one of the things that, like, I'm not going to say that it bummed me out more than obviously like what happened here. Brandon Lee lost his life, which is horrible. That's not something that should ever happen on a movie set. But Michael Massey, the actor who fired.
That's what I was going
to
ask.
Yeah. So to be super clear, like, in no way was this his fault.
Right.
That was not his job at all. His job was to do exactly what the director told him to. And by the way, this is not totally confirmed and it's pretty hotly debated, but you can listen to some interviews with Michael Massey from later where he talks about this. And I think he says something like, I wasn't even supposed to have a gun that day, that the director kept changing stuff at the last minute. Which again, like when you're on set, this is your first feature. I get it. You're very invested in this. You know, you're trying to make it exactly right. But like when you're making those kinds of decisions without the proper safeguards in place, stuff like this can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And as like an actor who wants a gig, you're not going to stand there and say no. And ask questions. You're just going to take the gun and do what the director says.
Of course. And, you know, this was his big break as well. As with every oral history, he'd said, like, I was going to light everything on fire and leave LA. And then I got this movie. And something that really bummed me out was that he passed away a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Every obituary that I found for him, the headline was, actor Michael Massey, who accidentally shot Brandon Lee, passes away at, you know, 65 years old. And it's like, he had an amazing career. Like, he went on to do a ton of stuff. He was a wonderful actor. This was completely not his fault. And yet it continued to define really his life after this.
Was he sort of tortured by it?
Yes.
I mean, it sounds like he was. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, this never left him. There are interviews with him that you can watch that are really heartbreaking. You know, one, he talks about, I guess, Brandon Lee's then fiance, because I think about a week after this movie wrapped, he was supposed to get married in Mexico to his fiance. You know, she remarried and she has a child. And he talks about how she actually comes into his wife's shop and he sees her child. And the only thing he can think is that's not Brandon's child.
Oh, God, how awful. Oh, how awful.
Strangers, do you ever have that thing where you realize you're clenching your jaw so hard you might just shatter your teeth? Or that you haven't taken a breath in, how long has it been? Listen, we're not supposed to function like this. And with CBD gummies from Cornbread Hemp, you don't have to. Cornbread Hemp uses only the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the most potent formula. They're USDA organic, vegan, and GMO-free, so you don't have to stress about what you're putting in your body just to help you de-stress. All their products are third-party tested for quality. Whether you're looking to just de-stress a bit, get to sleep, or get a little more funky, Cornbread Hemp has something for you. From their sleep gummies to their delicious THC seltzers, they've got you covered. Right now, Strange and Unexplained listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/strange, code STRANGE. Cornbread Hemp. This is the good life. Then there was another horrific tragedy on set as well.
Actually, there were several. It's a bit weird.
Oh, okay. Wow.
This movie, you know, Chris kind of alluded to this, but there were a lot of rumors swirling around Bruce Lee's death, that was potentially a curse, that, you know, perhaps it was the triad.
If it was a hit, like, why?
Well, I do think Bruce Lee, like, at least publicly seemed to act as if he was provoking the martial arts community kind of at every turn. You know, he would say things like, I don't believe in styles. Martial arts is a form of honesty and you have to, you know, learn how to control yourself and let it flow through your body. And he would kind of take jabs at masters of particular arts and styles and whatnot, Aikido and karate and things like that. So, but I think that was just lip service. I don't think this was anything that was actually going to cause somebody to go out. You know, there's a lot of posturing within these fighting communities, especially at the time. This was before UFC. This was before mixed martial arts. And so a lot of these fighting styles, you didn't want to actually fight each other because you wanted to be able to say, well, our style's the best and our style's... It's almost like a mutually assured destruction sort of situation. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there was anything to any of that. It's just a tragedy. And then I think Brandon Lee lost a lot of weight for this role before this role. His dad had lost a lot of weight, you know, before he died. There were just some ways in which one, I think, echoed the other, and it always fuels, you know what I mean, the speculation too.
And what's weird is that, like, the speculation that this movie was quote unquote cursed was rampant before anything happened with Brandon Lee. And that's kind of why we're bringing up the Bruce Lee stuff, is this was swirling around his father, around his father's death, and always had. So there was this kind of pop culture idea that, like, oh, this family's cursed.
Mm-hmm. And the comic book is about a cursed character, too.
Yes.
And the comic book writer was kind of cursed in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a really sad... I mean, what inspired him to write this comic was that he was very young and he was engaged to, you know, the love of his life. She was hit and killed by a drunk driver.
Oh, man.
And he really spiraled and then ended up writing The Crow as a way to exact the kind of revenge that he wished he could exact on this person who I believe they never found. So that's where it came from.
One thing that I love about the movie is that they're basically just fighting for renters' rights. Like,
yes.
I love that. Love that.
The comic's really cool.
Yeah.
But yes, so this was getting a lot of bad press for the movie itself being cursed. On the first day of filming, there was a 27-year-old carpenter who was severely electrocuted when the crane that he was working on was hit by live power lines.
Yikes.
His wife was literally about to give birth at that point. I think she said something like it would take about 5 years for him to recover from this. And I don't know if he ever fully recovered from that.
Yeah.
There was a unit publicist on the same day who was involved in a minor car accident. An equipment truck caught on fire. Like, this is day one.
Jesus.
A sculptor who was, because there's actually a lot of miniature work in this movie, again, because of the budget.
Yeah. I noticed that the first shot, right?
I think it's really cool. Yeah. The shots over the cityscape. It's all very, very beautifully done miniatures. But one of the sculptors who was working on it was apparently like amazing sculptor, giant pain in the ass. And so he was fired. And this guy's reaction was to drive his car through the plaster shop.
I think that might have been the one that I heard, although I heard it was a truck into the set. But okay. Wow.
There's more.
Okay.
So this is the wildest one. A construction worker slipped and drove a screwdriver through his hand at one point.
Oh,
this is not funny, but the publicist who got into the previous car accident told Entertainment Weekly at the time, it was serious, but it's not like he's going to lose the use of his hand.
Wow.
He gained function because now he has a screwdriver
in
his hand.
If anything, it's useful.
But I think what it actually highlights is that film sets, in particular, independent action film sets, right? An indie drama can be dangerous because you're working long hours and you have to drive home after a long day, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They tend not to be that dangerous otherwise, unless they're going to make a child make out with an adult, which, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
But especially when you are trying to do the stunts, the effects, and the physical maneuvering that big budget Hollywood films are doing, but you're trying to do them for a price, you can do things fast, cheap, good, pick two.
Yeah, right.
And with an indie film, maybe pick one.
But
you have to do them fast because you just don't have time. And safety, the fourth axis of that, you know, they never discuss safety. And safety is always the first thing to go. Even though I'm sure there were people on this film who were very focused on safety. It's just that if everybody's having to move that quickly, you know, some of these issues are someone's disgruntled and they drive through the film set. Okay, that's insane. But why does the power line hit that crane? It's possible the power line fell. It's also possible that people were moving too quickly and they swung the crane into the power line.
Yeah.
Why does, you know, the screwdriver go through the hand? We're having to work too quickly. You know, it's not giving folks enough time to do their work properly, or in the case with the gun, not having the right folks on set to monitor things to do them properly. And there's a certain amount of risk that I think most producers in this indie film space are willing to accept on other people's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would describe candidly as a lot of the stuff that Lizzie described, unfortunately, with everything up until Brandon's death, But really what this movie is, in my mind, is it is such a shining example of why you need basic safety measures. This is a work environment.
It's a cautionary tale for unions and safety.
And hiring the right people.
Yeah. Imagine like you have a construction site where they're going to be doing kung fu and also they're going to be shooting guns.
Right.
That's what a movie set is, right? Yeah, that's what the set of The Crow is.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it for 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, 50 days in a row.
Right. And you're catering is probably bologna sandwiches.
Yeah.
Like, if you're lucky. Yeah.
And right. like a little bit of Coke.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's an old school Hollywood table.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, again, what Larry Zanoff tried to emphasize when he was on our podcast was this was not an accident.
Yeah.
This was a series of decisions that resulted in a series of oversights and mistakes that resulted in somebody dying. I think he said there were 14 points of failure.
Wow.
Where at any of these 14 specific inflection points, somebody sat and thought and said, we should do the opposite of what we're about to do.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have happened. And in every one of those instances, it's not that they made an immoral decision at face value. It's that they made the easier, faster decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there continued to be rumors, obviously, about this movie being cursed when Brandon was killed, including the fact that, you know, why was he not wearing a bulletproof vest when he had been wearing a bulletproof vest earlier in the movie?
Oh, he had?
He had. And I don't have a great answer for that other than what Chris just said. They're moving really fast.
Yeah.
This is the end of the movie. You know, maybe they didn't want to have to conceal it. I don't know.
But like, for example, you know, we talked about The Godfather and when, you know, James Caan gets shot a billion times in that movie and he has all those squibs on him.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that was dangerous, he's wearing a bulletproof vest, right? That has a lot of the squibs on it. But a lot of those squibs are on other parts of his body, like his arms and his hands. And one of the things you can't do, again, just to show how dangerous even just a squib is, like you can't point your arm at your face when the squib goes off because it could eject something into your face, which could be very dangerous.
Wow.
And so even just with these very well understood charges or blanks or, you know, set explosions, again, gunpowder is being ignited. Objects are flying. Your eyes are exposed. Your mouth is exposed. Your nose are exposed.
Wow.
And then you add in he's not wearing a vest, etc. It's just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I know actors sometimes get shit for being overpaid, and certainly some actors are overpaid.
I was gonna say that's like the 1% of the 1%.
Right, most of us can barely scrape by, but when you consider what is asked of actors, especially on lower budget projects, you know, and again I think back to the Blair Witch Project and how they carried everything. There wouldn't have been a movie without them, and even if they'd been three different actors, it would have been a very different movie. And so, you know, actors deserve to get paid.
They do. And also, like, obviously you were / are a professional actor. I, you know, went to acting school. I thought I wanted to be an actor. And one of the reasons I very swiftly abandoned that upon reaching Los Angeles was it became very clear to me that as an actor, you have so little agency over your own career.
Yeah.
And that's true of getting cast in films. It seems to me that's very true once you're on the set. And so many other people on sets have so much more control over everything. The actors have control over their performance. A lot of times, unless you are a very big name, somebody who can throw your weight around, somebody who, you know, whether you have a financial investment in the film or your name is big enough who's able to ask for something different or change something, you are really at the behest of so many other people on set.
Yeah.
So yeah, actors need protection. They need to be paid well. A lot of times what they're being asked to do is dangerous. It's scary.
Yeah.
Strangers, did I just get another Mongolian cashmere sweater from Quince? Yes. Yes, I did. Am I obsessed? Yes. Yes, I am. Also, I was staying with a friend recently and I was raving about their sheets. What do you know? They were machine washable silk sheets from Quince. I was like, I love Quince. I have a million sweaters from them. They didn't even know that Quince has clothing. They do. Beautiful denim, machine washable silk, Mongolian cashmere, linen, leather, loungewear to fancy getups, all at least 50% off what you normally pay for the same quality. That's because Quince partners directly with factories, cutting out the middleman. But not just any factories. Quince only partners with factories that employ safe and sustainable practices, so you can look good and feel good about it. Step into the holiday season with layers made to feel good, look polished, and last from Quince. Perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Go to quince.com/strange for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/strange to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/strange.
How much of the movie did they then have to finish without him?
So this is where it gets pretty interesting and where they actually did some very innovative things in order to finish the movie. So initially this was supposed to be distributed by Paramount, and Paramount, citing that the release date obviously would be pushed, they backed out. They were like, we don't want any part of this. Yeah. You know, all the press around this has been terrible and, you know, he died. They were like, we're out.
Yeah.
It was actually Harvey Weinstein and Miramax that stepped in and gave them the additional several million dollars to be able to finish the film. And one of the reasons that the movie is dedicated to both Brandon Lee and his fiance, Eliza Hutton, is that she actually was really instrumental in getting the movie finished. She pushed really, really hard. She was like, please don't let this, you know, evaporate. This meant so much to him, and it would be a true tragedy if this does not air.
Yeah.
Which I think is really amazing that she had the wherewithal to continue forward with that after this happening.
Yeah.
But so there was an investigation. There was a criminal investigation into the shooting. Nobody was charged. I think they fined the filmmakers for negligence. It was something like $70,000. But beyond that, there was nothing else. You will hear some rumors that there is footage of the actual shooting in the film. Completely untrue. That footage was destroyed immediately following the investigation. It is nowhere in there. And they actually did quite a bit of editing around that scene so that you don't even really see him get shot in any way.
Oh, okay.
But so, you know, they were 8 days away from the end of principal photography. So pretty close to the end. There was not a lot that they had to cover that had him in it. There was a character called, I think, Skull Cowboy that was completely excised from the film just because there would have been additional shots of Brandon Lee needed. And also the director was like, we don't need him. He's in the comic, but they completely cut him, which, you know, sucks for the actor who was cast in that role.
Yeah.
But so do you remember the scene in Jurassic Park where the little girl is dangling out of the ceiling and the raptors are jumping up to snap at her feet? So if you watch it again and you look at her arms, you will notice that those are the arms of an adult stunt double. And it's her face that's superimposed over that person's face. And
superimposed?
Yeah. It was like one of the first face replacements. Yeah, in Hollywood.
It's one of the earliest. Yeah.
Looks great still.
It does look great. You can tell if you look closely at it.
Listen, I have seen that movie so many times.
That's a jacked 12-year-old.
That movie came out when I was in junior high school, and there was a $2 movie theater a couple blocks away from our high school, and we would cut school and we'd go to the $2 movie theater and we'd watch Jurassic Park over and over and over again. Actually, I first saw it on a date with, ready for this, Jordan Peele.
What?
We dated very briefly when we were like whatever we were, 13, 14.
What a power
14.
Couple.
I know, right? And later he would go on to credit Jurassic Park as, you know, one of his favorite monster movies. But I would say I know most of the continuity errors in that film, and there are quite a few. And also Laura Dern's stunt double when she's running to the shed is
definitely a man. Yeah.
That is a dude in a wig.
Yeah, yeah, big time.
If there ever was one.
With an unexplained belt and radio around his foot as he goes.
Yeah, because they cut the Sam Jackson scene.
So that had just happened. And that was, as Chris pointed out, one of the earliest examples of face replacement ever that was done so successfully. And so they actually, they use a little bit of that in The Crow. They do it very sparingly and they do it very well. It's, I think, the one scene where I know it's happening is when he's sort of standing by the window, the like sort of broken big circular window, and there's the lightning flashes and you see his face in full makeup and you see his body. So, you know, they're using the lightning to obscure it, which is smart.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is who is in that exact shot, but They used a couple different people to pick up some of the shots that they needed to get that would have had Brandon in them. One was his stunt double, Jeff Amata. However, they're very different sizes. I think Jeff Amata's relatively small. Brandon Lee was not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Jeff Amata was shorter than Bruce Lee.
Yes.
Jeff Amata's like 5'6". Bruce Lee was 5'8". And Brandon Lee was 6 feet tall.
He was a big guy.
A big guy, yeah.
He was a big guy. So they couldn't use him for a lot of the shots where you needed to really see the physicality of Brandon Lee. So they actually called someone who was a close friend of Brandon Lee, who was another stunt performer who had not worked on this film prior to that. And that was Chad Stahelski, who would go on to write, produce, and direct John Wick and create that entire franchise.
Oh, okay.
He was Keanu Reeves' stuntman on The Matrix. He's awesome. I got the chance to interview him once when I was working at IMDb, and really cool guy. So not only was he almost exactly the right size and shape, he looked a lot like Brandon Lee, even in the face. And again, Brandon Lee's in full face makeup for a lot of this.
Which is fortunate.
Right.
Yeah, they have like the similar kind of bone structure. Because Brandon Lee had like a pretty big jaw. You know, he was like a very recognizable look.
It's interesting to think like what would have happened to, you know, like what his career would have been.
Yeah.
I think something like actually what Keanu Reeves aged into with John Wick would be the sweet spot for Brandon Lee.
Yeah.
I think great physical presence, charismatic guy, probably a somewhat limited dramatic range, but that's okay.
Yeah.
And he totally could have carried a fun franchise like that.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Yeah. But so they used a bit of that face replacement on Chad Stahelski to replace Brandon Lee's face. It looks great. I don't think it's super noticeable. The other thing that they did, which is really impressive, was that I believe it's part of the same team that worked on the special effects on The Abyss, but they used existing footage of Brandon Lee that they had shot that they were not going to use in the final feature. And they actually rotoscoped him out. So they basically cut him out of existing footage, and they were able to use that footage in other settings. So they shot, Chris, tell me if I'm wrong, but they shot like, you know, the plates of the backgrounds that they were going to use. And then they actually cut him out and put him on those.
Wow.
And the lighting matches pretty well.
That's where it's really impressive.
Yeah.
And obviously it's a very dark movie. So like some of that, it's like, yeah, okay, it's pretty dark.
It helps to make a low budget if it's super, super dark.
I mean, that's why, you know, the T-Rex escaping the paddock at night.
At night.
You
know, everything's at night. Yeah.
And it's raining all of a sudden, and it's there's just one spotlight, and, you know. Right.
During the day, they're just like, where's the dinosaurs?
Yeah.
We can't light them. It would be a disaster.
You literally can't. But there is one shot that's, I think, very impressive, which they actually used footage of him walking down the alley in the rain, and they're able to use that to have him walk through a door into a building where the lighting changes. And you cannot tell. So they really did a remarkable job.
This feels like a stupid question, but was this done like manually or was this computer?
Yeah.
Now there are programs that can help.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But I still think the final passes, even on modern rotoscoping, are done, and a VFX artist can correct me if I'm wrong, are done by hand. Like there are algorithmic programs that can get you close to begin, but you still have to go in and fine tune everything by hand. There are these artists, every frame they go through and they do an incredible job, and it's all done by hand.
Yeah. Wow.
Even on a computer, it's still done by hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
It is really impressive. And there's a quote that I have from Chad Stahelski that I would love to read if that's possible.
Please. Yeah.
About sort of how this impacted him. He told Yahoo News UK, you know where that leads to? John Wick is 90% guns, firearms. But a lot of the safety or the methodology that we use, it came about because of that accident. It's retroactive, which sucks. It's like most fucking things in life. No one wants to change anything until something bad happens. But I know a great deal about that story, and there's no one thing you could point a finger out. It was a lot of little dumb mistakes that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And I also can't imagine for him as well, because this was his really good friend that he'd known and trained with for 5 years, and he's stepping in and doing this.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't help but, as I was watching the movie, just sort of think about how they must have all been impacted by it.
Yeah, I don't think you ever get over this.
I don't think that the actress that played Sarah, she didn't have much of a career, which, you know, it's always hard with kids because they're kids, you know, and especially like teenagers. But as I was Googling her, I saw that she had been asking for a boycott on the remake, and I didn't really dig into that. Do you know anything about that?
A little bit. I know Alex Piraeus also was pretty vocal about saying that he did not think that's something that should have been made. I'm inclined to agree. Nothing against the people who made the remake, nothing against Bill Skarsgård or anybody else involved, but this is not a franchise that needs to continue. This movie exists in a vacuum. It is Brandon Lee's film. I think you should leave it alone.
Yeah, it feels a bit disrespectful.
I think Rupert Sanders directed that new one. I don't think anybody involved came up with a good reason for why we needed to reopen this movie. Maybe there could be a good reason that, hey, we're going to remake it for this reason and it's going to be an interesting twist or whatever. That was never presented. Candidly, it seems like some probably somewhat opportunistic producer saw the rights were available and they pulled the disparate parts together. And I think Sanders was a hired gun. And again, no disrespect to Bill Sarsgaard and Danny Houston and FK Twigs, all of whom I like and other things. But I guess my other point would be, like, if you're going to do it, and nobody sets out to make a bad movie, but I guess if you're going to do it, know that it's risky because it's got to be really good for people to accept it. And this movie seems to have fallen far short of that threshold.
Or do something with it that changes it enough, which I know that they did make changes in this, but I don't think, to Chris's point, I don't think they were anything you could argue was like transformative to the initial film.
Right. Strangers, you know how I feel about therapy. I think we should all get it for free. But LOL, that's not how the world works. Until then, we have Rula, affordable mental health care online that takes most insurance. Rula does things differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. That's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. Think about it. You use your insurance benefits to maintain your physical health, so why wouldn't you do the same for your mental health? And Rula isn't just affordable. The experience is tailored around you. Other online therapy platforms might match you with the first available provider, whether or not they're the right fit. Rula considers your goals, preferences, and background to provide you a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who are actually aligned with what you need, because they know that finding the right therapist can make all the difference. No waitlists, no frustrating back and forth. Rula makes it easy to find a mental health provider who is accepting new patients, and appointments are available as soon as tomorrow. Plus, Rula sticks with you throughout your journey, checking in to make sure your care is helping you move forward. Go to Rula.com/strange to get started today. That's Rula.com/strange for quality therapy that's covered by insurance.
One thing I think we should clarify maybe for folks, because they might be wondering, with the Rust shooting.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Oh, yes. That has been popping into my mind.
So Rust was the independent Western film where Alec Baldwin, the gun he was holding, discharged, fired on set, and Halyna Hutchins, the cinematographer, and the director, Joel Souza, were shot. Halyna Hutchins died. Joel Souza recovered. People may be wondering why we've been very adamant that this was not Michael Massey's fault, whereas Alec Baldwin was not only taken to task publicly, but was put on trial for the death of Halyna Hutchins. I think there's a couple of key differences just to elucidate. One being the most important, in my opinion, being Alec Baldwin was a producer on Rust. And as a producer, ultimately, on-set safety is
your responsibility.
His purview. Yeah, exactly. He was not just an actor. I know he was an actor in that scene. So that's a really key differentiator from Michael Massey just being told what to do and handed an unknown live weapon on set. I do think the Rust case also really showed they did have an armorer on set, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, who, in a weird twist of fate, she is the daughter of one of the most famous armorers in Hollywood history, Thel Reed, who did all the Westerns, and we talked about him on Tombstone. She was very negligent with her duties.
She was.
Yeah, I mean, that was proven. She went to prison.
She was. I will say, again, this was an example of them cutting corners and cutting time.
Oh, no, of course. That's my point. But there was plenty of blame to go around. She ended up being the one who was saddled with it from a legal perspective. But this was clearly a set where the producers it seems, were looking for every opportunity to save a buck, mm-hmm. where the first AD struck a plea deal, I believe, because he was also under the gun, not to, you know, use a bad turn of phrase, but uh-huh. he was probably, it sounds like, cutting corners too, allegedly, you know, with how the process of getting the gun and handing the gun off, et cetera, on set were being handled. So again, I think it was simplified to this armorer failed at their duty, mm-hmm. that this was not like a smooth operation where everything was running perfectly well and there was one bad apple.
Right.
Again, if you have the responsibility of being a director or a producer on a set, something I've had the privilege of doing, like, it's up to you, you know, at the end of the day. And if you see somebody who's not being safe, it's not your job to react. It's your job to be proactive and go in there and say, okay, we're going to change things, or we're going to replace this person, et cetera.
Listen, I know that I get flack from some listeners about that everything comes down to capitalism. But listen, everything comes down to capitalism. And if you're working, if you're trying to cut corners to make as much money as possible, to save as much money as possible, if you're not paying your workers properly, if you're not making sure that the safety precautions are up to snuff, people are going to get hurt. People are going to get hurt. That is unfortunate. It also, you know, it strikes me that in that movie where I killed the rats, I also had a gun in my mouth and pulled the trigger over and over and over.
Oh my God.
And also pulled the trigger on someone's temple.
What movie is this?
It's called Ripe.
Was it like a exploitation movie?
No, I mean, yes, but no. Yeah. It was a movie about two twin sisters whose parents, shitty parents, die in a car accident, and they basically just like
go on a crime spree.
Out on their own. And well, no, that would have been interesting. No, they just sort of end up living on a military base, which is
weird.
Yeah. You know, I think if my mom had still been alive at that point and she'd read that script, she would have been like, nope, absolutely not. You are not making this movie. But I had a good time.
I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad you didn't smush those rats.
Yeah. But, you know, now knowing how dangerous it is, you know, I had like 10 minutes of gun practice and just how easily something can go wrong.
You're talking about how many guns you were handling after, you know, the death of Helena Hutchins on Rust. Brandon Lee's fiance did make some statements. And one of the things that she did was she actually posted an image of herself and Brandon Lee.
Oh.
And the caption was, there's no such thing as a prop gun. And it, sorry, it makes me really sad because you can see this image, but I think they actually show the image in the film and it's him holding her and taking a picture of them together in the mirror. Mm. And so she said, 28 years ago, I was shattered by the shock and grief of losing the love of my life, Brandon Lee, so senselessly. My heart aches again now for Helena Hutchins' husband and son. Ugh. And for all those left in the wake of this avoidable tragedy, I urge those in positions to make change, to consider alternatives to real guns on sets. Because that, like, you know, we talked about this a bit, but at this point with CGI, you don't need the gun to actually fire.
Listen, if you can have a dinosaur in a movie, you can have a fucking fake gun and
that's right.
And put in a CGI explosion. Oh, God, how awful and tragic.
It's really sad.
Yeah. And that movie has a lot of guns. I like John Wick. I like the first one.
I love John Wick.
Yeah. I like the second one. And then I just feel like it just gets sort of like gun porn. And I lost interest. But, you know, I think there's a time and a place and a certain type of film that they're effective. But yeah, there's no reason in this day and age to have a real gun on set.
No, I mean, I think people can make it. Chris, maybe you can speak to this more. People will make the case that, like, it changes the way that you handle it. There is a kickback in terms of if something is actually firing. I do understand all of that. I think there may be very special cases in which it does make sense. But my understanding is that for the most part, in most cases, you probably don't need to be firing anything.
Listen, we've all been watching Brad Pitt handle a gun for the past 3 decades. I think we can pretty much handle any goofy way you want to hold. That man uses a gun like he's Voldemort wielding a wand. It's absurd.
What's in the box?
Yes. What's in the box? Plus, also, like, we're actors, you know?
Yeah.
That's what we're trained to do, is make something that's not real believable.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Great. Well, thank you again so much for joining. And if you have not checked out What Went Wrong, I highly recommend it. It's so great.
Oh, thanks, Daisy.
Yeah, you're going to learn so much about what it takes to make a movie, and what goes into it, all the many, many, many difficult steps in making a film and what can go wrong. And things sure do go wrong often.
Almost every time. Yeah. Enough for us to have over 100 episodes.
Yeah. Very, very popular and excellent podcast. Well, thank you, Lizzie and Chris, so much. Thanks for joining, and I'll see you soon.
Yes,
thanks,
thank
Daisy.
You.
Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening. Check out the What Went Wrong podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and be sure to subscribe. I highly recommend it. Also, I looked for that diary entry, which I'm almost positive I've seen over the intervening years. I combed through 4 journals and couldn't find the entry. Instead, I just got very, very depressed over how messy my life was back then. Yuck. Someday, I'll write a memoir. But I don't have the time right now because... Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we'll meet June and Jennifer Gibbons and learn about their tumultuous lives as the Silent Twins. This episode was engineered by Jeff Devine. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grabbag Collab. You can get early and ad-free Strange and Unexplained by going to grabbagcollab.com and subscribing. If you have a topic you'd like me to cover, head to the website strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. I am way behind on getting back to emails, but I promise you I will. You can follow Strange on Instagram and TikTok at SNUpod and join the Facebook group to join in the conversation. Thanks, and stay strange.